On this week's prequel episode, we follow up on our Black Cauldron listener polls, learn about surrealism, and preview I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Hello and welcome back to another prequel episode of This Film Is Lit, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. We have all of our segments, including a Learning Things segment this week, so we're going to get right into it with our patron shoutouts.
I put up with you because your father and mother were our finest patrons, that's why.
We have one new patron this week at the $15 Academy Award-winning level, and that is Maxwell DeTuzo Martin. Thank you, DeTuzo, for supporting us at the $15 Academy Award-winning level. Make sure you get that recommendation in of what you would like for us to talk about so we can add it to the list. All right. Time to recognize our recurring Academy Award winners, and they are Maxwell DeTuzo Martin, Vic Dangerously, Matilde, Steve from Arizona, Paul, Jeff Niederhofer, Teresa Schwartz, Ian from Wine Country, Winchester's Forever, Kelly Napier, Grey Hightower, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Says Run Rabbit Run is out now, That Darn Skag, V. Frank, and Alina Starkov. Thank you all for continuing to support us at that $15 level. We really appreciate it. Katie, let's see what people had to say about The Black Cauldron.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Alrighty. Well, on Patreon, we had 4 votes for the books and 2 for the movie. Len Flakaczynski said, I don't remember anyone on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings saying they pulled inspiration from The Black Cauldron, but I know Peter said he drew inspiration from the 1978 animated Lord of the Rings movie, which I found a lot of parallels between the 1978 Bakshi Lord of the Rings and this version of The Black Cauldron, both condensing multiple books into one movie, and both definitely truncate their endings. Also, both have John Hurt in the cast. I know Brian said the Lord of the Rings movies might have drawn inspiration from this movie. I would lean more towards that this movie is just drawing from the Lord of the Rings imagery anyway. The scene that Brian is describing as the changed climax to this movie feels like it was just pulled from the end of Return of the King. There's some changes to the character's motivations, but Gurgi throwing himself into the cauldron looks identical to Gollum going into the fire. And I wonder if the ending was made because the author did not like that Gollum accidentally fell off the ledge. I enjoy in this version that the Gollum insert character actually makes a motivated choice instead of fate or happenstance saving the day.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that I wasn't really thinking about, because I have not seen the like Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
I have, but it's been at least 10 years
so
since
I
saw it.
Yeah, I couldn't say like if there are similarities from that to this.
Yeah.
That seems very likely to me.
It does. It
seems incredibly likely. I was simply comparing Gollum's voice specifically from the movies, which again may be similar in the Bakshi one. I don't know. Maybe
I don't remember.
Maybe they're both pulling from the Bakshi Lord of the Rings. And then also the other part that I was talking about was specifically the scene at the beginning where Gandalf comes in and is, you know, telling him to hide the ring or whatever, or take the ring and go, which again happens in the books. So it is, you know, which means it probably happens at least to some extent in the Bakshi version. So yeah, that is very possible that is what's going on. But there's still, I don't know, something about it just, it would not surprise me. Again, like as I said, I have not heard Jackson or anybody else mention this in any of the special features or anything for Lord of the Rings. So it's very possible that they hadn't seen it or didn't pull anything from it. But I don't know. There were some similarities that very well could go back to the Bakshi one. I also do like that. Again, I really did like the ending with Gurgi. I just wish they had built it up. I liked having him make that kind of conscious choice, motivated choice, instead of it just kind of happening, which has always been one of my, I don't want to say least favorite parts of Lord of the Rings, but I always thought that was kind of a strange ending.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that now. I'd have to go back and it's been, you know.
Well, I mean, I think the point is kind of just a little bit different in Lord of the Rings, because the whole point at the end of that is that if Gollum had not survived for the entire story, if Bilbo had killed him, or if Frodo had, or if Sam had, then the ring would not have been destroyed at the end.
And it makes no sense for Gollum to throw himself in with the ring. There's no motivational character change in that way. But the story is making the point of that their mercy, the staying of Bilbo's hand, you know, led to a good outcome. And so it's, you know, kind of a just a broadly kind of pacifist-y, vaguely kind of message. I mean, in a movie about war, or in a series literally all about war, it is still a kind of an ultimately empathetic and pacifistic message, which again is just different here. Or this one's more about the character arc and the character of Gurgi and the way he has changed. Whereas Lord of the Rings' ending is about Frodo and Bilbo and the way their empathy and compassion was able to lead to a good outcome.
Yes, kind of. Absolutely. Yeah. Our next comment was from Steve from Arizona, who said, "I'll always give it to the movie, even in spite of its flaws. I didn't see this until the 90s because my conservative parents labeled this as witchcraft." Yeah, I missed out.
There is a lot of witchcraft in it.
There is, to be fair. There is some devil magic in this one. I missed out on a lot as a kid. Anyway, thanks for a trip down memory lane.
Mm-hmm.
Next comment was from Matilde, who said, "The movie had some nice visual aspects, specifically the backgrounds and the color palette, but other than that, didn't bring out much emotion or interest for me. It should have been called The Black Cauldron at the Cliff's Notes. It was so rushed and barely touched the events of the books. It felt like a pointless adaptation." I could not agree with that more. "I felt like they made every character either younger or cuter in the movie, which makes sense for a Disney film, but removed even more depth, in my opinion. I think we need to find someone who's as obsessed with the Chronicles of Prydain as Peter Jackson was with Tolkien, then send that person to the Highlands for 18 to 24 months with a 9-figure budget so they can make a proper adaptation. I'd wait for it and devour it as soon as it came out. So obviously my vote went to the books. P.S. To my ears, Gurgi sounded more like Stitch than Smeagol."
There's definitely, I can see that too.
Yeah,
there's
for sure.
That's definitely in there. Absolutely. Which that would be another, that would be very likely that.
I would be completely unsurprised to find that whoever did the voice for Stitch
was
pulling inspiration from Gurgi.
Or somebody, the director or somebody was like, "Hey, I like this little fuzzy character that kind of looks like Stitch." Do that. But obviously I think, I don't know, there's something a little bit to it. There's some edge to it that reminded me more of Smeagol, maybe not more of Smeagol. Part of it for me is just that I'm much more familiar with Smeagol and Gollum's voice, whereas I've only seen Lilo and Stitch once or twice. So it's just not as burned into my brain. But I can definitely see that comparison. I think it would be very fun for somebody to, as you mentioned in the episode, go make a true big, epic adaptation of this series.
I think this series deserves that kind of treatment. I really do.
I think the biggest problem is that it doesn't have the marketing, the pre-built name that the Lord of the Rings does. I don't know how many people are going to be super excited buzz-wise about an adaptation of the... I would love to be wrong, and maybe I am, that there is more than I think. Who would be incredibly excited for a Chronicles of Prydain adaptation. But I do wonder if that's part of the reason.
I'm sure it is, because it has not had the kind of popularity that, you know, properties like Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia have enjoyed.
Yeah.
Our last comment on Patreon was from Bytove, who said, "The descriptions of the book show a closer tie to the older source material, while the movie is like 80s fantasy. The visuals are spectacular, and there's some genuinely powerful animation, especially around the Dark Castle and the Cauldron Army. That being said, the book scratches a particular nerd itch I have. The cauldron itself feels like a grail motif. It's a magical cup or bucket with power over life and death. Overcoming evil requires self-sacrifice, which is itself an homage to the crucifixion. The fact that the princely knight wannabe eventually does this reinforces the chivalry tropes. True knights sacrifice themselves in imitation of Christ. It's a bit much for some people, but I really like how the story feels connected to the older stories and myths. I just don't think the movie accomplishes anything spectacular with its narrative.
Mm-hmm. And I think even if you don't necessarily consciously like connect it in your head to those like the Christ myth or anything mm-hmm. like that, I think just it's pulling on a very rich tradition of
yes.
mythology that is very resonant for a reason with people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like it wasn't something that I even considered like yeah. upon watching yeah. the movie, but hearing it, it's like, oh, yeah, I could totally see the parallels there. But I think that, you know, yeah, like I said, regardless of how much you even connect to that story or whatever, I think just at its core, and this is, I think, what Bytov is saying, that at its core, there's a deep resonance with those types of stories,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons I think that, you know, the books were successful and people kind of latched onto them, is, yeah, it's grounding your mythology in sort of those. And again, going back to what I was saying in the episode about it being very clearly, you know, like a Joseph Campbell.
Yes. Like a hero's journey. Kind yeah. of thing, it pulls in on something that is very deeply embedded in the fabric of culture and the yeah. fabric of humanity.
Yeah, even if you don't realize it. Yeah. Yeah. Even if it's unconscious.
Over on Facebook, we had 3 votes for the books, 2 for the movie, and I think one person who couldn't decide, they used a different little react than the ones that I have in the graphic. Sweet. So I'm assuming that's what that was for. Yeah. Our first comment was from Greg, who said, I agree entirely with Katie's verdict.
Lots
here.
Of people.
Thank you, Greg.
Just, it's not the first. Didn't no. somebody else say the exact same thing? Anyways, yeah.
The book series is a stone-cold classic of high fantasy literature. The movie is a middling Disney effort, which, while it does contain some interesting ideas, visual elements, and adaptation choices, is ultimately and partially by necessity missing a lot of what makes the novel special. Alexander quite adroitly utilizes many of the standard tropes and character archetypes of the genre to tell a quintessential Campbellian hero's journey story, but to me, the two things that make the book stand above so many other works in this genre are the exquisite character development and his intermittent but frequently brilliant subversion of the aforementioned genre tropes, and both are lost to a great degree in the movie. Over the course of the books, not only Taryn and Alanwi, but also pretty much every other major character gets a nuanced, well-drawn character arc that pays off in a dramatically satisfying, emotionally affecting way by the end of the series. I won't spoil the ending for Katie or anyone else who hasn't read them yet, but there isn't a single character I can think of whose arc doesn't wrap up in a way that felt 100% right, resonant, and earned to me. In the movie, these characters either have their arcs truncated, Taryn and Alanwi, are mostly reduced to flat comic relief, Gurgi, Fluter, or are omitted entirely, Akron and Elidir, along with several others that weren't mentioned in the review. Similarly, many of the standard fantasy tropes and plot elements that the books employ, such as the magic sword that identifies the true king, the uncertain parentage of the heroine having latent magical powers that she must awaken by training with an old master, and the alien, inhuman magical race that is reluctant to intervene in the affairs of humans, end up playing out in ways that a reader conditioned to this type of story won't see coming, but that nevertheless land very satisfyingly. Again, mostly not until the later books in the series, so I won't spoil how. Several times, Alexander makes you think you're seeing a cliche you've seen 100 times before, and then defies your expectations in ways that surprise and delight. The movie simply elides most of these elements, and the ones which are included, such as Durnwin, the sword, it plays straight and strips of most or all of their meaning and narrative significance. As you guys noted in the review, a lot of this is a function of the movie trying to adapt the first of a series of novels telling an epic story into an 85-minute children's film. Perhaps Disney did the best they reasonably could given the restraints they were working under, though I'd argue that additions like Creeper and the frog cleavage Three Witches hijinks were unnecessary and could have been better replaced by a bit more of the novel's connective tissue. But I think they were fundamentally working in the wrong medium for an adaptation of this story. It could be done right as a series of full-length movies willing to adopt a more adult or at least YA tone. And like you, I hope that we someday, and hopefully done by the equivalent of the Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson and not the Hobbit trilogy one. Until then, though, I give this one to the books going away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nope. Sounds like pretty much spot on with a lot of what you had to say.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head that they were fundamentally working in the wrong medium.
Yeah.
To adapt this. It was never a good idea from the start. I don't think it was ever going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for sure. And I think a YA tone would be perfect for this series.
Yes.
I don't think it needs to be, you know, as.
No, I don't think it needs to be
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. I don't think it needs to be like Lord of the Rings or like The Witcher or something.
No.
I don't think it needs to be adult, but I think it does need like a slightly darker.
Yeah. It
like
just needs to be
older. More mature story.
Even just something, you know, along the lines of while I get what he's saying in terms of the quality of those movies, because I agree, I'm not a huge fan of The Hobbit, but the tone of The Hobbit movies is maybe closer to what, although the tone of The Hobbit movies is a mess, which is part of the problem, but because it bounces back and forth between, I do think, which, by the way, if you've never, I don't know, what was this person's name?
Greg.
If you've never seen the reasons behind why The Hobbit trilogy turned out the way it did, Lindsay Ellis has a great series, I think it's 3 videos on YouTube, but the fact that it's 3 is a spoiler for the review from my memory.
Yeah.
Because it's like, that's the big joke, is it's going to be a 2-parter, but then it ends up being 3 because that's what happened with the movies. She has a great series about like why, what happened and why those movies came, like, were the disaster that they were. And I don't even hate them. I think they're okay. They're just very clearly not on the same level of quality as the Lord of the Rings movies. But it's a very interesting series. If you've never watched it, just search like Lindsay Ellis, The Hobbit, and you should be able to find it. But she goes into great depth, like kind of researching and figuring out what went wrong and why and how everything turned out the way it did. The point being, I think absolutely you could do a YA series with the tone of like Harry Potter or something like that. That would.
Yeah, I think like the later, obviously it's a different kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
But like the later Harry Potter movies or Shadow and Bone.
That could work.
You could do something tonally similar to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, where, yeah, you have, you're there's dark, but it's not, you know, it's not like sex and violence necessarily. It's just, or, you know, not like graphic violence.
Right. It's just a little more mature than a Disney
animated
movie.
Cartoon.
Our next comment on Facebook was from James, who said, the movie. This is back when Disney had the stones to make really dark kids movies. This, The Black Hole, Return to Oz, before Disney committed to the cheese and saccharin of the movies they create now.
Did they make Return to Oz?
Disney? I think it was, I think it was maybe one of their like kind of subsidiary potentially.
It just says Walt Disney Studios Motion Pictures. I did not realize that was Disney, but.
And I'm not familiar with The Black Hole.
I have also never heard of The Black Hole.
I would argue that pretty much everybody was making weird, dark shit.
It wasn't just Disney.
It was not just Disney.
Yeah, and I think it's a little unfair to Disney's movies now. I think they make plenty of good stuff that has very deep, meaningful, complicated thematic. Complicated for children, should I say. Not like the stuff they're making is like the most, elevated, complicated media out there. But in terms of like, something like Frozen and stuff like that, I think there's interesting things and thematic messaging in those movies in their best stuff from the recent years. I understand the longing for the weird shit of the 80s and stuff. Like, I do wish we got more of that. I do wish that studios had the gall to make movies like that and put them in theaters more than they do. It's not like it never happens.
Yeah.
It's just a lot more rare than it used to be. But that being said, I think it's, it's a little unfair to classify everything Disney does now as cheesy and saccharine personally, but
I would agree. I think, I do see a difference even between like the stuff that they were making when we were kids in the 90s and like the kind of darkness level with that and like the stuff that they're making now.
Yeah.
Like I would consider like stuff like The Lion King, The Hunchback of Notre Dame to have like more dark elements than like your Frozens, your Moanas.
Yeah. Yes.
But I also think that what they're making, a lot of what they're making now is still good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just different. It's definitely just different. And I do think that there's elements that could have, but I also think part of that is you have to remember is that sometimes the things you don't realize the things that kids think are weird and creepy when you're an adult. I have heard people talk about in Moana, is it Moana? Yeah. What's the one? Is it Moana that has the Jemaine Clement playing the big crab? Is that Moana? People talk about that being weird and creepy. I have heard somebody specifically, I remember who it was, but somebody's kids were like, they won't watch that scene because it scares them.
See, then that is a good point, I think, because I did not find that scene creepy at all.
No, but
I honestly found it a little bit annoying.
Yeah, but like, but I've heard somebody, and again, I'm not saying that it's the same. It is definitely the stuff, some of this, like this movie and some of the other stuff from the 80s and that period, definitely way weirder and way creepier than that scene in Moana. But I also think you have to contextually remember that it's not like you're watching this stuff now as an adult and going, well, this isn't as weird as creepy or as creepy as the stuff when I was a kid, which sure it's not, but it's also, there is stuff that kids watch in those movies these days and go, get creeped out by. It's just different. I don't know. I think there's some context there that to consider at least. I've said this before, but I try to be very like, whenever I feel myself falling into a nostalgia hole of like, things were better or things were cooler or things were weirder back in when I was a kid or whatever, I always just try. I'm not saying that that's necessarily not true, because I think it often can be true. I just think it's a good thing to reflect on and consider, maybe I'm just not seeing the weird things now that are out there, or maybe they're not weird to me anymore because I've seen a lot of stuff and I'm an adult now. Or,
and that's like fair to say too, because when you're a kid, I think of everything as a little bit weird and a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
Because you haven't experienced a lot of things yet and everything's kind of new. Yeah. And new is scary.
Yeah. And so I just think it's something to consider when you're talking about that. And just again, it's not to say that you're wrong. Like, it's not to, again, reiterate, it's not to say that there wasn't more weird, creepy, strange shit back in the 80s, because I think there definitely objectively was. but there's still lots of weird, strange shit that you just, part of it is you have to go hard, you know. I think I will say this for sure. It's not as easy to find now in the sense that there was maybe more mainstream weirder stuff back then that was like Disney was making, which again, this is what this person is specifically saying. But you can find, I guess I'm tying this and relating this into a separate conversation of, you know, people complain about like, all there is the same comic book blockbusters and we don't have any of these good, there's tons of good movies. You just don't watch them. It's a thing that drives me crazy is when people, it's like so many good movies come out these days that you just, nobody watches them because but some of them even get theatrical releases.
Mm-hmm.
The Green Knight is an incredible film. Nobody saw it. We went and saw it. Yeah, super weird, super creepy, super cool. Nobody went and saw it. Yeah. We did. And it was great. But like, and that's the kind of thing. And yes, I know that's one example, but it's just like there is still stuff out there. You just, you know, and even some of it comes to theaters. You just gotta go find it and just, you know, just check that your rose tinted glasses are, you know, accurately calibrated, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I agree. And if you would like to hear us talk further about traumatizing children's movies, we did an entire segment on that in, I believe, the prequel to The Neverending Story, yes. Part 2.
Yes, one of those episodes, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was Part 2 that we did that for.
I think
for.
You're right. Which was a great, it was one and of my was, favorite prequels episodes.
It was upper echelon of learning things segments that I put together. I did journalism for that. I did, like, actual journalism
really
for that.
It was fantastic. Highly recommend going back and looking for that. I don't remember what it was called, like, what the, but yeah, it was one of the prequels to one of The Neverending Stories episodes. You should be able to find it pretty easy if you go look for that. So sweet.
Next comment on Facebook was from Warren, who said, I think I'm giving it to the books. I hope this comment isn't too long. Don't worry about it, Warren. If it's ever too long, I'll cut it down. I haven't read any of the books. Didn't even know it was a book, though I shouldn't have been surprised, as everything Disney comes from a different source. I actually thought you were talking about a different movie at first in the prequel. I had this confused with Quest for Camelot, but quickly cleared that up.
Hmm.
I rewatched this on Disney Plus. It's not as good as I remember. It's still enjoyable, but the pacing is off for me. It feels like it basically ends by the time we get started. It's not boring, more the opposite, where I'd like to be in the world a little bit longer, have some things fleshed out a bit. Giving up the sword and Gurgi's sacrifice could have been powerful moments, but the build-up to them wasn't strong enough for the payoff. I also think the animation is a bit dated, hard to describe, but the movements feel slow, especially during the action and on the Horned King, though the glowing effects on the sword and Henwin's vision still looked great. The design of the Horned King, though, is very cool, and I like how it subtly changes as the film progresses. He starts almost as a shadow, and quite scary for a kid's film. Then, as we progress and the heroes get closer to stopping him, he gets more detailed, and the colors brighten up to a point at his weakest, he gets red eyes. That, to me, really takes away his scare factor. And of course, by that point, our heroes win. It was kind of neat to see a villain become less menacing or scary as our heroes get closer to winning. That being said, the books sound like they flesh out stuff more in ways I like. Maybe a new set of films or a TV show could be great these days, but for now, I think I'll hunt down these books or see if there's an audio version.
I'm sure there is an audio version.
There, yeah,
like,
there
they're
is.
Popular
there
enough
is.
That they, yeah, I'm sure there's a, I'm sure it's probably great too. I wonder if they got somebody cool to, you know,
I don't know,
do the, yeah, do the reading, but. Yeah, it's a really interesting point about the progression of the Horned King over the course of the movie, and not one that I really noticed, but now that you mention it, I do.
Yeah, he definitely gets, like, more cartoony.
Yeah, 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 and which, I wonder if that was an intentional choice, or just a progression of, like, the anime, like, you know, like, they maybe they didn't really have him nailed down early
right.
on, and I don't
right.
know.
Because we know this movie went through a lot of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah. Struggles
I'm wondering
as it was
how
being
much
made.
Of that was intentional.
I would
know.
Like to think and hope that that was like a conscious thematic choice, because if it was, I do think that that is really very interesting.
Yeah.
That, like, as you get closer to taking down this villain, he gets progressively less intimidating.
Yeah, and just as you learn more about him, and because the unknown is what's scary, and the
yes,
more as,
yeah.
the more they're around him and see what his whole deal and stuff, I think that. That is interesting. Yeah, that's a really interesting.
I do think it's maybe pretty likely that it was just the animation department on the struggle bus.
Yeah,
but
could be.
But yeah. We can interpret it any way we like.
This is true.
Over on Twitter, we had 6 votes for the books, 1 for the movie, and 1 listener who couldn't decide. Shelby's in her capybara era said, I could take or leave the first book, but I was pleasantly surprised by the second one. It's been a while since I found a series that lets us watch a character grow so much over multiple books. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the series. The movie was at a disadvantage from the outset. As cool as the Horned King was, it really couldn't measure up.
I thought it was interesting. It seems like the character arcs is a big thing that and the character growth is a big thing that people kind of latch onto in this series, because Greg, who from Facebook, said that that was maybe their favorite thing about the series was the character arcs and the character growth and progression over the course of the series, and how that's so well done. And it sounds like Shelby kind of saying the same thing, which is Which is interesting because, yeah, the movie's singular, you just don't get.
No, not at all. And I definitely noticed that. Obviously, I have not read the whole series yet. I am waiting for book 3 to come in the mail. They sent me book 4 and I have not gotten book 3 yet. But even in like the first 2 books, I noticed that like it's the character growth is very well done. Like it's very subtle and just woven into the story in a way that's incredibly satisfying to read.
Yeah. Cool.
And our other comment on Twitter was from Kelly Napier, who said, "By leaps and bounds, the book. The first one was just okay, but the second one I couldn't put down. The movie screwed up the fair folk and Fluder so badly. The fair folk aren't fairies, and Fluder is not a weak old man. Dolly and Fluder are formidable members of the squad. The movie made them seem lesser than, and I didn't appreciate that. They also screwed up Gurgi. He shouldn't be adorable. I also missed the characters of Kahl and Prince Elidir. Elidir in the books helped Taran's character growth so much, and the movie lacked for not having that. Finally, the books do a great job of leaving the relationship between Taran and Elanwy undefined. Are they friends? Are they flirtatious? We never know, and it's lovely. We didn't need the definition of the relationship the movie forces on us with them kissing. The movie also sucks because they blatantly stole character design from other Disney properties. Here's just a few that I noticed. Dalban is Georges Harcourt from the Aristocats. Taran is Wart from The Sword in the Stone. And the Witches of Marva are the Evil Queen from Snow White, Madame Medusa from The Rescuers, and Madame Mim from The Sword in the Stone."
This, Kelly accompanied these tweets with images, yes. And holy cow, she's not wrong.
Yeah.
It is spot on.
You can
very
for
clear.
Sure tell that the animation department was taking some shortcuts.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, go check out on Twitter the thread for this, the poll thread, and you will see Kelly's tweets and you will see these images. And yeah, it's very clear.
Over on Instagram, we had 3 votes for the books and 4 for the movie. No comments. The Instagram poll is sometimes so out of pocket. It makes me laugh.
It's very strange.
I don't know. It's like most of the time it's pretty in line with the rest of like the polls and like the collective outcome, and then other times it just goes in a completely opposite direction for reasons I do not know. But our winner this time was the books, with 16 votes to the movie's 9, plus our 2 listeners who could not decide.
There you go. Fantastic stuff. All right. We're jumping back into a learning things segment. It's about to get weird because we're learning about surrealism.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world.
Surrealism is a cultural movement that developed in Europe in the aftermath of the First World War, the Great War, if you will. In which artists depicted unnerving, illogical scenes with the intent of developing techniques to allow the unconscious mind to express itself. That is the definition from Wikipedia.
Yes.
So according to one of the principal figures of the Surrealist movement, French writer and poet, I don't think that's right. I think it's André. Why didn't I write Andrew there?
Yeah,
it's not Andrew. André Breton.
Breton. Yeah.
Forgive my French, as always. the aim of surrealism was to, quote, resolve the previously contradictory conditions of dream and reality into an absolute reality, a super reality, a.k.a. surreality. Surreality?
Surreality.
Surreality?
I don't know.
Are we sure it's not surreality?
I'm not sure. But I think I would say surreality.
So the movement was influenced by the Dada movement of the 1910s, which is also super weird.
Yep.
And at the time of its like conception and popularity, it was considered associated also with political causes like communism and anarchism, the edgy political causes of the day.
Mm-hmm.
One piece of surrealist art that you might be familiar with, you've probably seen it at least in parody, is René Magritte's 1929 painting, The Treachery of Images, a.k.a. Ce n'est pas un pipe.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a pipe.
Very famous.
If you're not familiar with that, just Google "this is not a pipe." I promise you've seen this.
Yes, you've seen it. Everybody's seen it.
You've probably also seen. I didn't think to include this in here, but the melting clocks that I don't know the name of off the top of my head.
Isn't it just called like clocks or whatever?
I have no idea.
It's Dolly, right?
Yeah, it's a Dolly.
I'm pretty sure it's just called like clocks, but I could be wrong. I don't actually know that for sure. But yes, that would be another one.
Yeah. So works of surrealism feature the element of surprise, unexpected juxtapositions, and non sequitur. The movement produced many works and impacted visual arts, literature, film, and music, as well as politics. But for this segment, we are going to hone in a little bit more on film.
It's called The Persistence of Memory, by the way, is the name of the melting
See,
clocks.
I knew it had to have a pretentious title.
Yeah. And then just a reference for what Dadaism is that might be, because you mentioned it, the Dada movement, probably the most famous art piece from the Dada movement is The Fountain, which is the urinal. I think it's just called The Fountain, right? I'm pretty sure. It's just called Fountain, sorry, which is, yeah, Marcel Duchamp, and it's just a urinal that he wrote, like, his name on or something, I can't recall. But anyways, that's one of maybe the most, like, well-known pieces of, from, like, the, not art historians.
We're definitely not. we're simply nerds doing the best we can.
Yeah.
So, surrealist cinema is an approach to film theory, criticism, and production with its origins in Paris in the 1920s. Same time, same place as the surrealist movement overall. So, this movement used shocking, irrational, and absurd imagery, as well as Freudian dream symbolism, to challenge the traditional function of art to represent reality.
Yeah. I want to say this now so that people, I don't know how I'm going to feel about this movie. I truly have no idea. I've mentioned that I've never seen a Kaufman film. I am generally speaking, I understand the idea of surrealism. I get what it's doing, and I appreciate it doing that. That all being said, I'm not generally speaking a huge fan of surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do a lot for me. I'm a very, like, I don't know. Doesn't do a lot for me, generally speaking, apart from like that looks cool. Like there's a lot of times where I'll watch or see something that is like, surrealist, and I'll be like, that's gnarly and cool, but it doesn't really do a lot for me. Like even intellectually, I'm like, yeah, I get it, man. Like, okay.
I suspect that I might feel similarly.
Yeah.
Because I tend to prefer surrealism in small doses.
Yes.
Like, you know, if you have a movie or something that utilizes some surrealist elements, I'll be like, whoa, that was cool.
Yeah.
But if it continues in that vein, I'm like, okay.
I would also argue that almost is like, from my very limited understanding of surrealism as a movement and all that sort of stuff, using small parts of surrealism almost feels antithetical to the point of surrealism. If you're using surrealism to like highlight a point of your story in a way that like makes sense within the narrative of the story, you're like not even doing surrealism, kind of, from my understanding of surrealism.
I would tend to agree, because as I understand it, the whole point of surrealism is to make you question reality, and not in like a mental health kind of way.
Yes, but in like
but more in like a
structural.
Yes,
way.
In a structural like to help to get you to question like, why do we simply yes. accept that the thing yes. we call a table is a table?
And why do we accept the structures of society yes. the way they are? And I think those are all, again, I think that's all really interesting and important stuff. I find that there are types or there are art movements that I think challenge hierarchy and challenge structures in a way, in a similar way, but in a way that I find more interesting and like digestible. Mm-hmm. And again, I understand, trust me, I understand the point of surrealism is not to be digestible. I get that. It still doesn't really change my feelings on it necessarily. I don't know. Again, it's not, I don't know. We're going to talk about this a lot over the course of we still have more in this learning thing segment. And again, over the course of the episode and stuff, yes. I'm sure we'll talk more about
it. I'm sure we will.
But it is one of those things that I am going into this trying to like preface it with the fact that just generally speaking, this kind of stuff doesn't do a lot for me. Generally.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see though.
All right. So back to surrealist cinema. So surrealism was the first like artistic movement to become like closely and seriously associated with film, which makes a lot of sense because both surrealism and film were in their infancy at the same time period, born together, grew up together. Its popularity was fairly short-lived, but it has become known for its dreamlike quality, juxtaposition of everyday people and objects in irrational forms, and the abstraction of real life places and things. Mm-hmm. So surrealists sought to redefine our awareness of reality by illustrating that quote unquote real was little more than what we perceived as real.
Right.
But that reality was subject to no limits beyond those that we imposed on it. Okay. And film, especially in its early, most mysterious days,
yeah.
was the ideal medium for kind of meeting that goal. So you have all of these new techniques to play with,
yeah.
right? Superimposition, overexposure, fast motion, slow motion, reverse motion, stop motion, lens flares, depth of field, all these other camera tricks that you can use to create dreamlike qualities to a piece of film in ways that couldn't be achieved in static mediums or even in film's closest cousin, theater.
And this is the thing that I most appreciate surrealism and the movement of surrealism for, is that it pioneered a lot of techniques and visual ideas in mm-hmm. cinema that were then aped and used by other people to produce stories I cared about. So like, or to produce stories at all, because yeah. generally speaking, a lot of the surrealists, they can't have a story by definition. Like, mm-hmm. that's the whole point. And so I that is, to me, what I find most fascinating and interesting about surreal, especially the surrealist cinema, is again, I'm glad that these weird French people were doing what they were doing and coming up with weird shit and weird cool things to do with cameras, so that later on Spielberg could be like, hey, what if I did something like that, but with.
Yeah.
And I just said Spielberg, whatever. But point being that so that, you know, people later who are actually, you know, creating stories again that I find interesting and care about could utilize those elements of surrealism. And again, this kind of goes back to what you're saying. Utilize these elements of surrealism in their broader actual mm-hmm. non-surrealist narratives in a way that's really engaging and interesting. But again, becomes not surrealism because it has a point. So. Let me clarify that. Surrealism has a point. God.
Oh,
talking about surrealism
fun.
Is exhausting.
So surrealists saw in film a medium that kind of nullified the boundaries of reality, and noted the resemblance between film's imaginary images and the images of dreams and the unconscious. As a surrealist filmmaker, Luis Buñuel,
mm-hmm.
Buñuel, I don't know. Stated,
it's got an
quote,
Enya over the end.
It does. And I, yeah, quote, the film seems to be the involuntary imitation of the dream.
Louis Buñuel is one of those people that I recognize. I actually watched some of his stuff in film classes when I was in school. And he's the dude, I recognize his name. And I was like, I'm pretty sure he's the dude who did the Eye movie, which I could not remember what it was called because it's French. But he is. Him and Salvador Dali directed it, wrote and directed it together. It's like a 16-minute short film. It's just on YouTube. 20-minute short film. It's just on YouTube. It's called Un Chien Andalou.
Mm.
And it's one of maybe the more famous short films ever, but specifically, especially it's maybe the most famous surrealist cinema ever put to film. But it is probably most known for, and the thing you might know it for, is in the opening, towards the beginning of the movie, there's a scene where this dude like uses a razor blade and slices a lady's eye. And it's like very visceral and like, you see it and there's a cut and it's clearly like a prop, like mm-hmm. it's like a grape or something, but or it's probably not a grape, but whatever, it's a prop, but it is like you see it and it's very like and it mm-hmm. Probably the thing that most people would be like, oh yeah, I've heard of that or I've seen that or whatever, and then it goes on to be chaos and nonsense for another 20 minutes, 15 minutes, but it is interesting. And there's a whole, one of my favorite things, I was reading about this, and this is in France at the time. They made it as like to offend the delicate sensibilities of the bourgeoisie, mm-hmm. and then the bourgeoisie fucking ate it up and loved it, and they were so mad about it, which is hilarious to me in its own meta way. And then some rich motherfuckers paid them to make a sequel to it. I was going down this rabbit hole this morning, and I thought it was so fascinating that they're like, we'll create this thing that will offend, you know, the sensibilities of the bourgeoisie, because it's, you know, it's this chaotic nonsense that and it was, to be fair, lots of people did find it very offensive. It was boycotted and all this sort of stuff, but also like the rich French aristocrats all thought it was like brilliant high art and loved it, and were like, and they were like, what the fuck. Anyways, so again, this is what I was reading this morning. I thought that was very fascinating.
Some other early surrealist filmmakers include René Clair, Germaine Dulac, Man Ray, and Salvatore Dali. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's Salvatore Dali.
Yep.
Modern filmmakers, sometimes cited as creating surrealist films or using surrealist elements, include David Lynch, mm-hmm. Fernando Arrabal, Alejandro Jodorowsky, Stephen Sayadian.
I don't know.
Brian Patrick Butler, and the director of this film, Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah, Jodorowsky is, and I mentioned this in our Dune episode, there's a documentary. He was, I believe, after or before, I can't remember if it was after or before David Lynch's Dune.
Mm.
He was working on an adaptation of Dune that ballooned into this chaos nightmare that never got made because of budget. I'm not seeing the documentary. Supposed to be a very fascinating documentary, but Jodorowsky is an interesting filmmaker. I've seen parts of, he has a, I don't know if it's the most famous film, but one of his most famous films is called The Holy Mountain. And I've seen clips from that, or parts of that. I haven't seen the whole thing. But he is an interesting filmmaker for sure. And I like David Lynch, generally speaking. Twin Peaks is great. Not super surrealist. It has surrealist elements to it. For sure, and some parts of it are very weird, but some of his other movies are way more out mm-hmm. there than like Twin Peaks is. But
so since the rise, popularity, and eventual decline of the movement, critics have debated whether surrealist film actually constitutes a distinct genre. The rub here, as I understand it, seems to be that in order to establish a defined genre, you have to be able to cite many works which share thematic, formal, and stylistic traits. And some critics feel that due to surrealism's use of the irrational and non sequitur, it is actually impossible for surrealist films to constitute a genre, and that it's instead more accurate to say surrealism in film than surrealist films.
I guess,
Which to me, like, I get what you're saying, but also this feels like, it feels like we're really nitpicking here.
Yeah, I can see what they're saying for sure. The inherent nature of surrealism kind of keeps it, you know, out of classification to some extent.
Which is the entire point.
Yes,
of
which
it.
Is the point. But that being said, you can be like, well, all this stuff that doesn't make any sense and is not chaos nonsense, that's surrealist cinema. Yeah. Like I don't know. Like I get it. And what I will say is that I think it's tough with people like Kaufman and Lynch and of what I know of their films. There's tons of surrealism, and it is, but they're also have narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some surrealist cinema literally just doesn't
have just a narrative. Images.
Like it's just images. It's scenarios, it's weird scenes like lumped together. They don't have narratives. And so there is at least some complication there for sure. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting discussion. I'm not nearly versed enough in the topic or well read enough on the topic to come down on one side or the other there of whether or not we should categorize it as a genre. But I don't know.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion for sure. All right. Well, now that we have that nice little primer on surrealism, let's learn a little bit about our story this week, which is I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Jake, my boyfriend.
It's snowing.
Winter is coming in.
We have a real connection, a rare and intense attachment. I've never experienced anything like it. I'm thinking of ending things.
Huh?
What?
Did you say something?
I don't think so.
Weird.
I'm visiting Jake's parents for the first time. He hasn't been my boyfriend for very long.
They really are looking forward to meeting you.
I think of ending things.
Hello? We're here.
Oh, hi. Oh, it's all wet.
Here they come.
Jake has told us so much about you.
He's told me so much about both of you, too.
And you came anyway?
Jake tells me you're studying quantum psychics.
Physics.
Really?
But there's just something profoundly wrong here.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
I'm Thinking of Ending Things is a 2016 novel by Canadian writer Ian Reid. It was his debut novel. According to Reid, it took about 3 years to write this novel, although ideas for the story, he said, had been with him for far longer than that, usually how that goes in my experience. He has also stated that he drew on his experiences growing up on a farm in remote Ontario, as well as traveling Canadian country roads in total darkness. So Canadian listeners, this one's for you.
There you go. April was already excited. She was like, hey, I like this, or read this book in our book club.
The novel had some trouble getting picked up initially. Reid recalled, quote, just about everyone in Canada rejected it. It was eventually accepted by Simon & Schuster, and it went on to be a New York Times bestseller, translated into over 20 languages, which is pretty cool. The novel received mostly positive reviews. In the Chicago Tribune, Lloyd Sachs called the novel, quote, the boldest and most original literary thriller to appear in some time. And I'm a little ways into it, and it is the most literary thing I've read in a long time.
Yeah, which we don't do a ton.
Yeah,
of,
we don't
like,
do
really.
A ton. Literary fiction tends to not get adapted.
Yeah, for a reason, probably. Yeah.
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 But yeah, it is that struck me like as soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh, this is the most literary thing I've read in a hot minute.
Yeah.
Hannah Pittard of the New York Times felt differently about it, calling the novel, quote, gimmicky, and stating that the ending, quote, hastily disposes of unexplained and unnecessary red herrings, and the revelation is at once too tidy and too convenient to be satisfying. So I'll have to see how I feel about that, see if I agree with Hannah or not. Writing in The Australian, author Pip Smith said that the novel, quote, reads like a short story with its elastic stretched to the snapping point, but also felt that Reed, quote, sells his concept short by sticking to the thriller format. So it was not literary enough for that person. The movie that we'll be discussing is the only adaptation of this novel, but there was an audiobook edition also released in 2016. So if you'd prefer to listen to it, you are in luck. Mm-hmm. It's formatted kind of weirdly, though. I don't know if I would like just listening to it.
It does. It wouldn't surprise me if this would be a tough one.
Yeah, I feel like it would be. The novel was selected by National Public Radio as one of the best books of 2016. It was a finalist for the 2016 Shirley Jackson Award, and it appeared on the 2017 Ottawa Independent Writers Frank Heggie Award for Emerging Authors long list. So it did get some accolades.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. All right. Well, let's talk about now the movie. I'm thinking of ending things.
I think of endings.
I am so glad Jake has found someone.
Soon this will all be a distant memory.
Who's this?
It's me.
No, who's me?
I tell you, I would misplace my own head if it wasn't screwed onto my own head.
I feel like I was seeing them as they were. Seeing them as they will be. Seeing them after they're gone. I'm thinking of ending.
You can stay here. Excuse me? You don't have to go.
I don't have to go where?
Forward.
People like to think of themselves as points moving through time. But I think it's the opposite. We're stationary. And time passes through us. Blowing like cold wind. Maybe this is how it was always going to end.
First thing I wanted to mention is Googling this movie is not fun.
I noticed immediately that if I did not put either book or movie at the end of it,
yep,
you get all of the suicide hotline numbers immediately.
Which is nice. I'm glad. Yes. I am glad that Google does that. But I was like, all right, I'm thinking of ending things, and it's just like nothing but like, please call this number. I'm like, wait a sec. Oh, okay, yeah. But I'm Thinking of Ending Things is a 2020 film written and directed by Charlie Kaufman, who's known for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich, Schenectady, New York. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. I've heard it several different ways. And Anomalisa, among other things. The film stars Jesse Buckley, Jesse Plemons, Toni Collette, and David Thewlis, among a handful of others. But those are the four main stars. The film has an 82% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 78% on Metacritic, and a 6.6 out of 10 on IMDb. Side note here that I thought was super interesting when I was Googling this. On Google, they have like a review thing that pops up, mm-hmm. kind of similar to the suicide line. Like you know that like, I guess it's Google reviews. I don't know, but yeah. It's just the thing when you Google it, it pops up and is like shows you like reviews of a movie or whatever that are not sourced from IMDb or whatever, because these are 5-star reviews. And on Google, this film has a 2.3 out of 5.
Interesting.
But it is almost entirely 5-star and 1-star reviews, with the ones vastly outnumbering everything else.
Huh.
There's a handful of 2, 3s, and 4s, but it is a lot of 5-star reviews, and then a whole lot of, it's probably 50% 1-star reviews, 25% 5-star reviews, and then the other 25% mixed between the 2, 3, and 4. And that matches with what I've heard people say about this movie, mm-hmm. which is that either people are like, this is brilliant, amazing art, or people go, what the fuck was that? I hate it. It's like no in between from what I have heard. We shall see, I guess. So the movie did win a bunch of smaller film festival and critics awards, but it did release on Netflix, so it didn't get, and this is before, I think this is like the year before, maybe, they allowed Netflix stuff into the Oscars and everything like that. I don't know if it would have been or not, but I'm pretty sure this was like the year before they started doing Netflix at the Oscars. I could be wrong. But there was also no traditional box office for this because it was a Netflix release. So getting into a few production notes, I don't have a ton because there wasn't a lot about this, and I did some more Googling and looking for making ofs and stuff, and I couldn't really find anything. So I don't know. I don't have a lot of information, but I got a little bit here. The adaptation was announced in 2018, and the initial casting for the two main characters, which I thought was interesting, was Jesse Plemons, who went on to continue to play the character, playing across from Brie Larson. Was initially going to be the female main character, and then in 2019, Toni Collette and David Thewlis joined the cast, and at that point, Jesse Buckley replaced Brie Larson. And I imagine I couldn't confirm this, but I imagine it had to be because she became Captain Marvel, because the timelines match up.
I would think so,
because Captain Marvel came out in 2019. Yeah. Avengers and everything. So yeah, I'm sure
being in the MCU is a time suck.
Yeah, so I have a feeling that's why she left this project, if I had to guess. Interesting fact, this film is shot in 1:37 to 1 aspect ratio, which is known as the Academy ratio, because it was standardized by the Academy of Motion Pictures and Arts and Sciences in 1932, which is 1:37:1 is it's like a square format, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of looks like... It's almost 1:1, obviously. 1.3721 is pretty close to 1:1.
Yeah, pretty close.
It's also the same aspect ratio of another movie that we watched called Cold War, which I will talk about more in just a minute. But it was Cold War, which we did as a patron bonus episode way back.
Yeah, a while ago.
3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I believe was also in Academy ratio. And according to Charlie Kaufman, Netflix actually pushed back against using this aspect ratio because they thought that viewers would think something was wrong with their TV, because it is, again, not your traditional widescreen format.
I mean, fair enough.
Yeah. In an interview, Jesse Buckley, who plays one of the main characters, stated that when she got the script from Charlie Kaufman, he described her character, who is just called Girlfriend. She doesn't have a name in the script. He described her character as, quote, molecular, end quote.
That is in line with what I've read from the book so far.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. I'm not even sure what I would, but interesting.
It wasn't, hang on, I made a note about it, because it was not molecular, but it was something else weird.
Like a term that you used, or
no. Somebody refers to her, describes her as therapeutic.
Oh, okay.
Which is not quite the same thing, but also like a weird way to describe a person.
Yeah. Yeah. Described her as molecular. Another fun fact, supposedly this is from IMDb's trivia. So again, I don't know for sure that it's true, but I thought it was interesting. Supposedly one of the wigs that Toni Collette wears in the film was originally made for Stranger Things. And it was the wig that the kids put on Eleven in the first season to like give her hair. And then they modified it for Toni Collette to wear, but apparently, which would make sense as a Netflix movie, potentially.
Yeah.
The film was shot by Lucas Zoll. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. Who we know, as I mentioned earlier, from the patron bonus episode, he shot Cold War, which I do remember thinking was absolutely stunning. So I'm interested to see the cinematography in this film, because Cold War was just gorgeous. So getting into some reviews. Karen Hahn, writing for Polygon, said, quote, "The lack of clear answers and structure can be frustrating, but the strange way the story is told enhances just how real the exchanges between characters feel. The frustration that Lucy feels with Jake, that Jake feels with his mother, that his parents feel for each other, are all uncomfortably tangible, especially as tensions rise." Maybe she does have a name in the movie, but in the credits, she's just listed as Girlfriend. I swear...
I don't know. As much as I read of the book, she does not have a name this far.
That's the thing. I could have swore that I read that on IMDb, the credits, it just said Girlfriend, but here it's saying the frustration that Lucy feels. So I don't know. We haven't watched the movie yet. So the frustration that Lucy feels with Jake, that Jake feels with his mother, and that his parents feel for each other are all uncomfortably tangible, especially as tensions rise. The film's 134-minute runtime is a long time to sit with that feeling, but Kaufman's big divergence from the novel he's adapting is in lending its ending a more buoyant note.
Interesting.
So it changes the ending a bit.
Noted.
The Observer's Wendy Eyed wrote, quote, "This is not cinema that leaves you feeling good about things, nor does it tread a familiar path. But I'm Thinking of Ending Things is one of the most daringly unexpected films of the year, a sinewy, unsettling psychological horror saturated with a squirming dream logic that tips over into the domain of nightmares." Then, in a couple more mixed reviews, Adam Graham, writing for the Detroit News, gave the film a C. And he praised Plemons and Buckley's performances, but did not like the plot, writing, quote, "I'm Thinking of Ending Things is an unsolvable riddle where the only answer is mankind's hopelessness, and we've been down this road before," end quote. And then for Time, Stephanie Zacharik wrote, quote, "For every moment of raw, affecting insight, there are zillions of milliseconds of Kaufman's proving what a tortured smarty he is. I'm Thinking of Ending Things must have been arduous to make, and it's excruciatingly tedious to watch."
That end does quote. Not make me feel hope.
An incredible review. I love it. I may like this movie, but I love that she wrote that review. It just cracks me up. And then finally, obviously at this point, Ebert has been dead for quite a while, but writing for RogerEbert.com, Brian Tallarico gave the film 3.5 out of 4 stars, saying, quote, "It is a movie that is undeniably complex in terms of symbolism and a more surreal final act than most people will be expecting." He also praised the cinematography, saying that the film's atmosphere is, quote, "amplified by a tight 4:3 aspect ratio." It's not 4:3, technically, by a tight almost 4:3 aspect ratio, courtesy of Lucas Zal, this Cold War cinematographer, that forces the viewer to pay more attention to what's in frame. There you go. So those are some reviews for I'm Thinking of Ending Things. This is one I've been wanting to watch. I actually had no idea this was a book. I had been wanting to watch this for a while because I've heard people talk about it, and I've heard both ends of the spectrum from people whose opinion on movies that I like. I have heard people go, "This is nothing, this is terrible," and I've heard people go, "This is amazing, this is incredible." I don't know. I truly don't know, and I'm very excited to watch it. But this was a patron request, wasn't it?
It was, yes. This was a patron request from Jeff Niederhofer.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Jeff, for giving us this excuse to watch, well, at least me this excuse to watch this movie. I don't know how interested Katie was in seeing it, but it'll be interesting nonetheless. As always, you can do us a favor by supporting us on Patreon. If you give us $15 a month, you can recommend something to us like Jeff did there, and we will get to it when we can. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Goodreads. Make sure you do whatever you need to do notification-wise so you see our posts, and that would all be super great. Katie, where can people watch I'm Thinking of Ending Things?
Well, I apologize to anyone who does not have Netflix for this one, because that's the only place you can watch this.
Yeah, it is a Netflix original. It is on Netflix, so that is where you will be watching I'm Thinking of Ending Things if you're going to watch it. So.
I guess maybe you can pirate it.
You could pirate it, and there may be some... maybe in other countries it might be weird, but I imagine probably not.
Yeah, probably
It's probably just on Netflix everywhere, if I had to guess. So there you go. Like I said, I really am looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it, but I'm also preparing myself to be really frustrated. Because although I will say that going in knowing that it not only dabbles in surrealism, but runs face first into surrealism. And you know, kind of knowing what I'm getting into may help.
Mm-hmm.
I think my biggest frustration with movies is sometimes if I'm struggling to find the meaning and thematic through line of a film where I'm expecting there to be one. And I'm not saying this one won't have it. From what I understand, it does. I think going in knowing that it's intentionally confusing and frustrating, at least to some extent, will help my sense of frustration.
At least you'll know what to expect.
Yeah, I think will help my sense of frustration at least a little bit. And I like I said, this is my first Charlie Kaufman film. At least in its entirety. I've seen parts of Eternal Sunshine. I've seen parts of Being John Malkovich, but I've never seen any of his films in their entirety. So, I think it should be a lot of fun. It should make for an interesting discussion, if not a confusing and frustrating discussion. We shall see. We shall see in 1 week's time. We're talking about I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Until that time, guys, gals, my bad, and pals, and everybody else.
Keep reading books.
Keep watching movies.
And keep being awesome.